Serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. The staff at Owens Funeral Home invite you to join them in supporting public radio.
And good morning. Welcome back to hour number two of Focus 580. I'm David Inge, the host of the show. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. So if the first hour of the show didn't completely scare you away, all of those who are comfortable with isotopes and the periodic table, we're glad to have you with us this time around, because here is a program. It's completely accessible, open to all, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be talking this morning about language and about the English language. Dennis Barron is here. He's professor of English at University of Illinois. And occasionally he's here on the program to answer questions, to respond to complaints. We have talked off and on over the years many times about language and how it changes. Sometimes in ways that we don't like, but tough. It does that anyway, and it does in spite of people's attempts to stop it from changing. It does. It is very dynamic, so it continues to change. We could talk about that. From time to time, people have questions about grammar, and we are happy to take those. Certainly, if people have complaints about what they consider to be misuse, you're welcome to do that. Any and all of these kinds of questions, when Dennis is here, that's what we do. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to give us a call, 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It's good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, David, and it's great to hear grammar being characterized as a whole lot easier than physics.
if I thought about that for a little while, it might be a toss-up. I was never really all that exceptional at either, so naturally I'm a talk show host.
There you go.
And not a physicist or a professor of English.
Right, you just play one on TV.
Exactly so. Was there something in particular that you wanted to talk about?
I don't want to talk about anything. I'm just here to listen and to nod. And, you know, language change is like one of these inevitable chain reactions. We're going to split the linguistic atom and
end up with lots of polluted leftovers.
Lots of words that are left over that we don't know how to get rid of them.
Exactly.
You know, we ought to take them and bury them. English has 500,000 words. The English language, if you use the Oxford English Dictionary as a rough guide to the English language, has 500,000 words in it. And how many of those are you using every day? How many of these do you really need? Most of these are, you know, they are like spent plutonium. And we need to shovel them up, put them in freight cars, and truck them to some, you know, tunnel underneath a huge mountain in Nevada or you know, somewhere in one of those lesser populated states.
But then what happens if some language terrorist goes out there and digs some of them up?
That is right.
And then goes into the middle of downtown Manhattan and just throws all those words out. Then what happens?
I mean, that's why we have Homeland Security, to protect us against the, you know, wanton dissemination of vocabulary.
But seriously,
serious.
How many,
David? This is my bread and butter.
I'm sorry. Sorry for casting nasturtiums. How many words on average? How many words? And I'm sure someone has in fact counted this. Most of the time, how many words do we use?
Okay. Well, to paraphrase a recent president, that depends on what the meaning of word is. But.
Okay.
We can go into that in a minute. But actually, the estimates for vocabulary size of the average American high school graduate, 12th grade graduate, range from about 40,000 to 70,000 or 80,000. And some of it does have to do with, you know, what you're actually counting as a word. I'll give you an example. It is a, the indefinite article, and the other indefinite article that you use when the next word begins with a vowel sound. Mm. Are those counted as two words or one? Is I and are I and me, are those two words, or are they just variants of one basic form that we call the, you know, the first person singular pronoun? So some of that is dictionaries that want to increase their word count them as separate words.
Is that and when you have a dictionary, is it important?
Oh,
that
yes. Oh, yes. It is a highly cutthroat
list a big number on there. It's like,
yes,
we have
absolutely
this many words.
Look on your average college desk dictionary and on the dust jacket, and you will see now with 85,000, 86,000.2. You know each new edition has to one up the one before it because the profit margin is very small and the competition is very intense. And most of us are just looking up the words online anyway, so I don't know why they bother.
We have someone here.
Our caller from Springfield, Massachusetts, Merriam-Webster, just hung up.
This is someone.
He's busy drafting me an email.
Someone, yes. See if we let you use our words anymore. This is someone calling from Paxton. Gave up.
We lost the Paxtonian. I'm sorry.
We're going to hang up. All right. Anyway,
I used too many words. 333-9455.
Toll free 800-222-945. Here's a caller. Interbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
There's one word that really bothers me because it's so misused, and that is the word like.
Ah. You don't like.
I don't like.
Mm. Like what do you mean?
Instead of using such as or similar to.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. And I can't think of a sentence right now, but it seems to me I read this all the time.
As in Winston tastes good like a cigarette should.
Yes, there you go. So.
Well, I mean, the simple thing to do is get the Surgeon General to ban that kind of stuff. That's how we got rid of that slogan.
Well, let me ask,
like is bad for your health.
Why is that wrong? I'm asking Dennis here.
There's a complicated grammatical explanation, but in fact, it's not so wrong as everybody seems to think it is, because it is common enough in speech and writing that most people, most experts, recognize it as an alternative to as.
So.
Purists don't like it because they say, "Well, what, you know, you got to say as this is as good as gold." I mean, you can't say this is like good as. Yeah, I'm getting confused here, but yeah, you're right not to like it, but people who use it are okay using it too.
For instance,
the response to the Winston slogan. I don't know if you remember this far back, because I don't know when did they yank cigarette advertising? When was that? Winston campaign was in the 60s or 70s.
Yeah.
The company, responded with another slogan, which was, what do you want? Good grammar or good taste? So they got a lot of mileage out of that, and they cast the person complaining about what that person thought was an inappropriate use of, like, they cast them as an old fuddy-duddy.
A nudge.
You should pardon the expression, professor type. And these young, hip, sexy singers and dancers would whirl this poor guy around in his chair singing, what do you want, good grammar or good taste? And so, what I said at the time was, they took that complaint and they laughed all the way to the bank with it, the advertisers. Well, this is what I mean by the chain reaction. It's unstoppable. You don't like it. Okay? Great. What are you going to do about it? Dig a fallout shelter in the backyard and hide out.
probably not a very satisfying
six
response,
inches of lead shielding surrounded by a couple of feet of concrete. That's about it.
Oh, well. Now you've done it.
Now you've done it. Got two hang-ups in the
this
first 15
This is the kind of
minutes.
Stuff we have come to expect from you, this level of irreverence.
Yes.
That's why we keep asking you back, actually.
You ought to read my blog. which I should plug at this point.
Sure.
The Web of Language.
All right.
It is a whole series of posts in this sort of acerbic, hyper-witty, and nasty Eastern Establishment style that I have come to claim as my own.
Well, if now, see, now it's all well and good to say here is an instance where we were taught one thing as opposed to another, and when and one sounds right to us, it sounds good to our ear. Mm-hmm. When we hear the other one, we just it's like the proverbial fingernails on the blackboard.
It is, it is.
And you would say, well, now, in a sense, usage sort of dictates what's acceptable, and if you get enough people saying one particular thing one way, that's going to
that trumps sort of, the sort of formulaic, you know, rule bound way of looking at language. The thing is that language doesn't behave logically; it behaves according to rules in the sense that it's very systematic. It follows certain patterns, and certain things are definitely disallowed in terms of, you know, combinations of sounds or word order or things that don't make sense. But if you want to narrow that down to a sort of a logical straitjacket, you find that, that language doesn't work like that. One of the early examples of linguist who pointed out this disconnect between logic and the way language works is I think was in the early 1900s. This guy Sterling Leonard said, "You take the expression 'you light a pipe.' Well, that's wrong. That's literally wrong. You don't light a pipe. You light the tobacco in the pipe. Mm-hmm. So if you want to be a purist about language, you couldn't say I lied about you. He's, you know, a journal. Okay, journal literally means something that is written or published every day, because jour is the word that means day. Okay, but it's common for us to call things journals that are published weekly or monthly or four times a year or annually.
Give me an example of something in English that is an absolute rule that cannot be broken, is never broken, that everyone would agree that is a rule and that's that.
Okay, well, the analogy is to the rules of playing chess.
Okay.
Let me back up before I give you an example of it from English. There are certain rules for playing the game of chess. Pieces move in certain ways, okay? Pawns move one square at a time, except in certain kinds of situations. They capture diagonally, and initially a pawn can move two spaces. A knight moves only in certain kinds of patterns. A bishop moves only in certain kinds of patterns. So if you take that piece, and there's nothing to stop you from taking that pawn and moving it the way you would move a knight, but if you do that, you're not playing chess. You're violating that kind of what we call constitutive rule, the game rules. Mm. Okay, that's a foul. Mm. Okay. So, for example, in English, the definite article always comes before the noun. If you put the definite article after the noun, and there's nothing I can do to stop you if you want to do that. Book the. Instead of the book. Okay, nothing I can do to stop you other than to look askance or give you a low grade or something like that, or, you know, put you in a fallout shelter lined with 6 inches of lead and 2 feet of concrete and, you know, give you food and water through a slit in the door. But you won't be using English.
So
those are the kinds of rules that are hard and fast. They tend to be things like word order rules. They tend to be things like if you say something that doesn't make sense, cannot be made to make sense.
So then the ultimate test is, can the person to whom you are speaking, are they going to understand?
Is communication occurring? Yeah, that sometimes we do that, but then you get into these situations where you got two people and one person says something and the other person says, "I don't understand you." And then you have to decide whether they actually don't understand them or they are somehow refusing to understand them because they don't like what is being said or how it's being said. They don't like the accent. They don't like the fact that they're using, like, you know, You know, when the kid says to the teacher, "Can I go to the bathroom?" And then the teacher smugly says, "Well, I suppose you can, but you may not." And, you know, of course the teacher understands the double negative. I don't got no money. Can I borrow $5? I don't got no money. When somebody says that double negative, "I don't got none," you know, logic dictates that two negatives make a positive. But are they affirming? Do you come back and say, "Well, you just told me you have money, so why don't you give it to me?"
You must have some.
Yeah, yeah. You know what they mean. You just don't like the way they're expounding.
All right. We're talking this morning with Dennis Barron. He's a professor of English at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while,
I just got back from vacation. I should be relaxed and friendly.
Me too. I'm in a bad mood already.
All right, let's. I'm gonna reboot.
All right.
Okay, you take a call, and I'll reboot while we do that.
All right. The caller is in Kankakee on a cell phone, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question to you is, how come that after a conversation that you have, you might have with Professor Barron, you say, "Thank you very much, Professor Barron," and he says, "Thank you," instead of saying, "You're welcome"?
That's an interesting phenomenon, and it's fairly recent. By that, I mean, you know, 10 years, maybe a little longer. I don't know. I haven't tracked when this sort of thing starts happening, but you start noticing people saying, "How come you're doing that? How come, you know, thank you." You see notices. You know, "We will be closed over the noon hour. Thank you." Why? Why? Okay, so how do you analyze that? Okay, obviously it's not the same sense of thank you that we're used to, but it is some kind of politeness tag. It's something that's saying, it must be saying something like, "We appreciate your understanding for our being closed," or "Thank you, you're welcome," "Thank you, thank you." It reminds me of the "after you, no, after you, no, after you." You know, it's sort of, "Oh, don't thank me, it was nothing at all, I'm thanking you for asking," or something like that. It's just a new spin on a politeness close. And why do we need this? Why does this, well, I don't know if we need it. Why does it happen? It happens maybe because things that are commonly said tend to lose their significance. The more you say something, the less it means.
Thank you then becomes less significant.
Yeah. And so maybe it's a way of, you know, well, maybe not that thank you becomes less significant, but the thank you, you're welcome, the you're welcome becomes, you know, it's the such a predictable response to thank you that, I don't know, this is just a hypothesis, but there seems to be something going on there with the sort of fact that these things tend to be relatively meaningless. They are just sort of end of conversation formulas.
Okay. Yeah, it just is unnerving at times when you hear it all the time.
Oh, yeah, it is. But it is a thing that is spreading, and people are noticing it. And yeah, people don't like it. Some of them, other people just.
So I just have to get over it.
Well, I don't know if you have to get over it. You can continue disliking it until you find yourself using it, because that's the other thing that happens. We, you know, I complain about things once in a while, too, and I find, oh, my God, I'm using it, too. So you can't win.
So remember at the end of the conversation to say you're welcome.
All right. And thank you.
You're welcome.
No, thank you.
All right. We appreciate the call. We're right, getting close to our midpoint here. We have some other callers who would like to talk with us, and we'll go next to Robinson, line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis, I would like your input on a phrase that I've started hearing much more frequently than ever. This is the phrase, "back in the day."
Ah, yes.
Can you recall when that first started?
Well, I don't know. Again, I don't know exactly, but it has had a slow evolution into mainstream speech, and I think it comes, my guess is, my understanding is it comes from African-American slang, and it's one of those expressions that has spread from a small group to a wider usage in recent years back in the day.
Well, that's what I was suspecting. I hear it most often in black speech, but not at all exclusively.
Right, right.
Whereas when you and I grew up, we would have said in the old days.
Yeah, back in the day, we would have said the old days.
Right. Okay, just wondered how new it was or why I'm hearing it more often.
Yeah, and you know, another thing with these sorts of expressions, you know, in the old days becomes a kind of trite formula, and so people sometimes appreciate a new way of saying the same thing.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right. It seems to me that that is an important point, and it provides some of the answer to the question, why does language change? Because people get bored. They always like new ways of saying things.
We are afflicted with ADD when we use language. You know, our attention wanders, and we are in constant need of additional linguistic stimulation. Mm-hmm. We are creative with language. We do. We like to play with it. We like to have fun with it. We like to invent or adopt new ways of doing things. Just try them out.
And sometimes go back and grab old ones and put them back into circulation again.
Yeah, that happens too.
All right. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign. Line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm still back on thank you. If we may go back a bit.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
I think one reason for answering thank you with thank you, especially when someone is being interviewed through his expertise, I think when the host says thank you, the person who says thank you in return means thank you for being interested in whatever my expertise is and for choosing me to be the spokesperson to clear some of this garbage up.
Yeah. Instead of, you know, thank you for talking to me, it's, no, thank you for consulting
for
me.
Right, and because time is an important element in broadcasting, it just comes out, thank you. And now
well, I don't know if that's
that
any
true.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm feeling much better about it.
Okay. I'm surprised no one has mentioned yet the other alternative to thank you, which has sometimes been getting some flack, which is no problem.
Oh, I hate that. Especially
thank you. No problem.
From somebody who's supposed to be doing what I expect them to do. And, you know, thank you for coming with your ambulance. Oh, no
problem. No problem.
Well,
no.
To heck with you, buddy. I called your number and you're supposed to come.
Yeah.
Well, that's my contribution for this morning, and I'm enjoying this very much.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
I
know. We'll take a long time getting away from that. Thank you. You're welcome. I think that we talked about this once before. Perhaps someone asked about it. No problem. And we talked about what was happening there, and I guess I think the thing that I thought at the time was that we have gone from a point where when we say you're welcome, it says something like, you know, I'm happy to have done this thing for you.
And this further minimizes the, you know, it was, you know, I could have done it in my sleep. It was really, it didn't bother me at all. It was so easy for me to do. I'm happy to have helped you out kind of thing. It was, you know.
I almost thought that when you say no problem, it's not, we're going from saying I'm happy to do this for you to it does not inconvenience me. To do
well,
this
okay, this is what
you.
People think. This is how people who don't like it react. Say, well, it wasn't. But I think it's really a kind of way of being diffident, of saying, you know, oh, it was no problem. It's all, you know, it's all in the line of duty. I mean, this is what I'm here to serve.
I think you may be putting an unwarranted positive spin on this.
Okay, maybe I am. It's probably, you know, people who use this stuff, they don't think about why they're using it. It just happens.
And then when we
these tags have no meaning.
When we go back and explain it, I think sometimes we're just making stuff
we're
up.
We're making stuff up right and left.
All right. Dennis Barron, a man who never makes stuff up.
Oh, well, that's not true.
a man who sometimes makes stuff up. He is a professor of English at the University of Illinois. Every once in a while, he's here on the program. We talk about language, and your questions are welcome. Thank you. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Where are we going to go next? Rentoul, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two short things. A term that you have used, I've lost count. The two words, how come? Mm-hmm. Do they not mean why? Mm-hmm. And so how come you are using how come? And I have a little personal thing. For an English professor, sometimes your enunciation leaves a lot to be desired.
I know. Yeah, My mother always...
Maybe you were, you know, your tongue was still on vacation.
No. I'm like this all the time. My mother used to say I talked more clearly at 18 months than...
And do you purposely go down further than you think you really need to?
When he comes on this show, he's definitely slumming.
Oh, come on.
I didn't mean to.
No.
Okay, tell me something about how come.
How come?
I'm going off the line.
Right. It's just an idiom. It's an informal way of alternate for why. Not as bad as how's come, I suppose.
Hmm. So, again, it's one of those things.
How come
just,
do we say it? Because it's an idiom. And just, you know, it's certainly less formal. And so it may be in these kinds of informal talking situations. It sets a slightly different tone. Why is a little bit more direct, a little bit more intrusive, a little more, I'm putting you on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
How come is... Maybe if you had a mind to come up with an explanation for this, you could share it with us.
How long has how come been around? Long
I
time?
Don't know. Long time. Long time. Long time. Long time.
All right.
Much longer than any other. Longer than no problem. Longer than... Probably not as long as like for as, but longer than thank you.
All right. Let's talk with somebody else. Paxton, this is a cell phone person. I think we had them before.
I hope this is the one who we lost before.
Right, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Sorry, I lost the cell before.
Oh, okay.
Just a quick question and a comment, and I'll ring off and listen to the answer. You can perhaps help me solve an argument between my wife and myself. She said that irregardless is either inappropriate or not really a word. And I've heard it used before, actually, by, on newscasts and by politicians. So I was just wondering your take on it. And then I think you might have covered this before, but we just got done completing a run of the play Pippin. And inside the play, it's words like infillade and defillade. And I'm like, okay, now what are they talking about? And I looked it up, and of course it has to do with battles. But I'm wondering, you know, is there a shelf life to these words, and you know, through non-use, that they just kind of wander off and die, you know, a slow, painful death. Mm-hmm. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thank you so much.
All right.
Okay. Well, the first one, irregardless. A lot of people say it's not a word, and it's used far too often. Think about that. It has to be a word if it's being used far too often. It's what it is a word that people don't like. And because regardless is already a negative in the sense that it means without regard, irregardless is treated as a kind of double negative and therefore should be banned, expelled, buried deep within a mountaintop.
So it is...
Okay,
it is
a word, and
not,
people use it. And,
oh,
and,
okay.
And you know, we have lots of words that are negative, and we add a negative to them. So, the one I'm thinking of is debone. Okay, mm-hmm. When you think about you got a fish, let's say, and you can say I boned the fish, which means you remove the bones, or I deboned it. But for some reason, debone doesn't get that kind of flack that irregardless gets, even though it is technically a double negative.
Well,
as for the second question,
yeah.
I don't recognize the words that our caller was talking about from the play, Pippin. But what I could probably guess is going on here is that these are old military terms, and military terms die out when the military technology changes. Hmm. Sometimes they adapt. Okay, so you shoot an arrow and then you shoot a gun. Okay, but sometimes they just die out, like a lot of the terms for medieval armor. Or old kinds of battle formations and things like that. They're no longer used, so they drop out of the language. So my guess is that this is simply a couple of archaisms that are put into the play because it's a modern play to give it an old-fashioned flavor.
All right. Do you think, just going back to regardless and irregardless, do you think that one day it will be the case that there is no more regardless, that everyone says irregardless?
I don't think so.
Have both of them?
Yeah. I mean, of course, that's always possible. But right now, my sense is that regardless is the major form, and irregardless gets used sometimes. And people who don't like irregardless portray people who use it as uneducated or vulgar. In some way, doesn't seem to stop the usage, but I don't know that it's particularly spreading either.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. There are a couple of usages that bother me, and I wonder if I should get over that. For instance, people say like myself instead of like me.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is the improper usage of I for me. Or, mm-hmm. And you hear that all the time.
Yeah, yeah. My brother and I. Give it to my brother and I instead of my brother and me. There have been a number of explanations for this, and the myself, I think, is similar in the sense that one of the explanations, and I'm not sure I buy this, is that we have been, in our formative years, drilled in school or by parents or people who correct us to avoid me in constructions like me and him went to the store. Children say this and then they get corrected out of it. And so they hypercorrect by avoiding me in situations where they're supposed to say me, like between, you know, you, me, and the lamppost. So I don't know if that's really a good explanation. It seems to me that it just has become a kind of formula that sticks. And so that you know, so-and-so and me, I don't think I use it, but, you know, if you listen to me, maybe you'll hear me using it. But I certainly hear lots of other people use it. And if you point it out to them, they say, well, what's wrong with that? I don't get it. What's the problem? And these are people who would use, you know, if it was any other pronoun, if they wouldn't say, give it to my brother and she.
Hmm.
They would say, give it to him and her. So it only happens with the first person for some reason. The self happens with all of them. There has been this increased use of the reflexive pronoun. I don't know why that is, but it is certainly a noticeable sort of thing. It has something to do with the fact that people think maybe that the non-reflexive form is less correct or less polite or less formal somehow.
Did you have another question?
Well, the other one is the usage of me, no, the usage of I where me belongs.
Yeah, that's the between you and I kind of thing. You're supposed to say, because between is a preposition, you're supposed to say between you and me. But you hear between you and I a lot.
Oh, all the time.
All the time. And I think it's just become a kind of formula. People just sort of use it automatically. Because they won't say between you and he. They'd say between you and him.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, I think.
All right, so I guess I ought to get over my aversion.
No, you don't have to get over your aversion, but I'm not saying get over your aversion. I'm saying there's probably not much you can do about other people doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's a difference between those two things. You go on and dislike it. It's perfectly healthy to dislike certain forms of language. Nothing wrong with that. I hate all sorts of things that people say and do.
Yes. Well,
but
don't think you can do anything about it.
I don't know that I can do much about it. Yeah. You know, that's the sort of, you know, language has a mind of its own kind of thing.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You did it, David.
Thank you. And let's go to Vermilion County, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Well, the previous caller mentioned two of my three. I would just add that if people who are speaking might say between my wife and me, myself, or between us, mm-hmm. us and me go together, or they gave it to my wife, they gave it to me, they didn't give it to I, if they would separate things down to...
Yeah, yeah. That's right. They never make those kinds of errors, but they do the between X and I, and it's often with between.
Yes.
Or give it to X and I.
My third one was that it seems to me that in interviews recently, particularly with politicians or military people, I keep hearing the overusage of at the end of the day, at the end of the day, over and over.
Yeah, at the end of the day is the new bottom line.
Yes.
I guess.
Anyway, I get tired of hearing
that. Yeah, people rely on these formulas because that's what formulas are for, to ease us through.
Thank you.
Conversation. And you're right, at the end of the day, and when we get tired of that, we'll find another one to use.
And unfortunately, those of us
when it's all said and done
do interviews listen to a lot of other interviews, so I think it can be
it's
something
contagious.
Like that can be a virus.
Yes, it's contagious.
Yes, it is.
Absolutely.
Yes, it is. All right. Two.
If you see it in an email, don't open it.
I never open my email. There's no telling what
safe.
Might be in there. That's right.
Safe.
I don't want to know what's in there. Line number three, Rantoul. Hello.
Well, hi. I'm so glad your guest is here, and obviously he's touched a lot of people who this subject is important to, including me. I hope I said that right. One of the things I've noticed in the last few years, and it just annoys the dickens out of me, is the media making up their own definitions. In other words, I noticed that it started with harass. It's no longer harass, it's harass. It's no longer homicide, it's homicide. Mm-hmm. And the one that just makes me feel like someone is scratching a blackboard with their fingernails is short-lived. Well, okay. This trend is short-lived.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious about this phenomenon.
Okay, well, okay. So first of all, these are alternate pronunciations of words that, you know, are common enough that I guess I haven't noticed the homicide for homicide one, but I'll start listening for that. I don't know that it's the fault of the media as much as it is just something that people are doing and the media is or are, depending on whether you want to consider it singular or plural, sort of reflecting that practice.
Well, I assumed it was the media because I have never heard educated people use those pronunciations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I know that dictionaries are compiled by asking educated people how they pronounce words and what their definitions are.
Well, dictionaries are compiled not by asking educated people what their pronunciations and definitions are, but by observing a whole range of speakers and writers and recording the pronunciations that are heard and sort of, you know, plotting statistically what the frequencies are in terms of saying which one is the major pronunciation, which are minor pronunciations, that are secondary pronunciations. And the definitions, we don't say, well, what do you mean by that? But we try to figure out what the definition is in terms of the context, how it's being used, because pronunciations and definitions are somewhat fluid. They change over time from person to person, from area to area, from group to group. And the reason, one of the major reasons that we need dictionaries still is because we come upon words and pronunciations that seem unfamiliar to us, and we'd like to check to see either what they might mean or why perhaps they are different from what we expected.
So it's your viewpoint that, for example, the word impact, which I always assumed was two vehicles crashing into each other,
mm-hmm.
In other words, the word is no longer how have you been affected, it's how have you been impacted.
Okay, well, that's just a switch in word choice. The use of impact in those sorts of things is, well, you know, 10 years, 20 years maybe. It's just something that's happening. I don't know that we can blame the media for this. They are transmitters of it, certainly, but are they initiators of it? Probably not. One of the interesting things that we struggle with is figuring out what is the impact of mass media on language change and on language usage. In some senses, it has a very strong impact. For example, when Stephen Colbert coined or recoined the word truthiness a couple of years ago.
What was the word?
Truthiness.
Truthiness.
Yeah, truthiness, which was selected as word of the year 2 years running by two different organizations. He meant by it something that seems true but is actually not. And coining it on the air on a show that had a large audience, it spread rapidly across the country. And we have begun seeing it occasionally in print as just a word. The truthiness of the statement was blah, blah, blah. And the question then is, how lasting is the impact of this coinage? You know, is this a word that's going to stay around for a while, or is it a word that was just, you know, like a meteor? It was there, and it flashed for a while, and then it was gone. So we're still in the kind of stage where we're sort of tracking what happens to it. There's a lot of people who think, yeah, it was a big flash, and it has no staying power.
Well, thank you very much for your comments. Bye.
You are welcome. We have about 7 minutes left, maybe, in this part of Focus 580 with Dennis Barron. He's professor of English at the University of Illinois.
So if somebody says thank you and you reply, well, I'm glad you thanked me because it was really a great inconvenience for me to do this, is that really better than saying no problem?
Well, it might be more honest.
Are we looking for honesty here?
Do we place importance on honesty?
Are we looking for honesty or are we looking for politeness?
I think probably most of the time, for maintenance of social order,
yeah,
we're looking for politeness, or else fights would be breaking out
constantly.
If you
said, you know, hi, how are you, and I actually told you
next
how
time I
was,
saw you, I wouldn't ask.
You wouldn't want to know.
That's right.
That's not the answer you were expecting.
Well, we have some other callers here. We'll see if we can get them in the time that remains. Next is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. How are you, speaker? It was a joke. Subjunctive is what I'm calling about.
Would that you were doing that, yes.
Yes, and if I were you, mm-hmm. I would be cautious about this. But I'm very particular about
yes.
subjunctive. But sometimes I get called on it, and somebody says, well, that's not the way to say it. So would you give us some rules of the road for that?
Well, that
for
would
some examples.
Yeah, that would take a long time. If I were to do that,
which you have,
which I just did, if I was going to do that, you know, people worry about is the subjunctive dying, but of course it's not dying. It's a verb construction that's used for things that you would like to have in the future sometimes, or for things that are not existing but might exist. You know, the things contrary to fact.
Yes,
sometimes.
Contrary to fact. Is
yeah.
What
so
I thought was always pretty easy to figure out. I mean,
yeah.
If I were you,
yeah, but
and
but
not.
Lots of people simply use the simple tense instead of the subjunctive. So they would say instead of if I were going to do that, if I was going to.
Well, I assume that's
do that.
Because they don't know subjunctive.
Maybe. You can know it and still not use it, I suppose. I think there's probably a lot of people for whom the subjunctive is not a particularly operative. Is that a problem? I don't know, because there certainly are plenty of people who still use it. It's like, you know, it's like whom. People have been saying for hundreds of years that whom is on its way out. It's a dying pronoun. The
whom are you going to vote for? I think
yeah.
it's appropriate.
Well, yeah, but plenty of people say, who are you going to vote for?
Oh.
And I think in informal speech, I would probably say that. I think back to, you know, the first TV show that I remember seeing Johnny Carson on on television was a daytime quiz show called Who Do You Trust?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Remember that? And my comment there is that you know, only maybe even not on public television could you run a show called Whom Do You Trust?
Well, don't you think the content would be more important than the name? I mean, I wouldn't.
Yeah, but then you just undercut your defense of the subjunctive.
Uh huh. Okay. All right. So any.
Stick to the subjunctive, you know, it's certainly got a place in our hearts and minds.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Let us continue. Next caller here is another Urbana listener, line two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get back to thank you.
Okay.
And responding with thank you. I think I have a little bit of insight into this because I lived overseas for a number of years, and I think it has to do with modesty.
Okay.
You thanking me, it would be immodest to say you're welcome because you're assuming some level of, I don't know, authority or control or yes, I did help you sort of attitude. Instead, by saying thank you back,
yes.
You're being more humble and modest. In Britain, I learned very quickly when people ask you, you know, how are you? It's considered very immodest to say, I'm fine, how are you? You're supposed to say, not so bad.
Huh.
And that's considered a more modest or humble way of interacting in the morning.
Right, of course, well, the British speak without opening their mouths, too, but I think that's what I meant when I was talking about diffidence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a modesty.
Yeah.
Don't thank me. I should thank you for, you know, for asking me.
Right.
Yeah.
Modesty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know that about the Brits. They actually want you to say that you're not feeling so great.
Yeah, well.
Because it would be hubris.
Yeah, exactly.
It's hubris to say. It's you know, it's boasting to say, I'm great.
Exactly.
Whereas Americans, if you don't say, I'm great, which is the expected response, even if you're miserable, you're thought of as rude.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
It's interesting. Different cultures have these different politeness conventions.
I found that very interesting.
In some cultures, I don't know, probably the Japanese don't even want you to ask.
I wouldn't know about that.
It would be considered intrusive. I don't know.
And
how
I
are you?
Well,
this is none of your business.
And if I could, I have one last question
sure.
to settle an argument between my husband and I. If somebody
there you go.
Is speaking in a way... that's sort of demeaning or putting someone down? Is it that they're speaking in a patronizing way or a patronizing way?
Either one.
Really?
Yes.
It's equally correct, equally acceptable.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think there are alternative pronunciations.
Well, how often can a husband and wife both be right?
Half the time.
Yeah. Thank you.
that sort of goes back to harass and harass. I'm sure that in most dictionaries, both those would
insurance
be there.
Insurance and permit and permit.
I suppose the way I was taught was that whichever pronunciation comes first is
tends to be the more frequent or preferred. It depends on the dictionary. I think Webster's, Merriam-Webster's, the order of pronunciations reflects the popularity of the pronunciation.
So, well, actually, that's interesting that you said what they're doing is they're listening.
Yes.
They're just listening to how people are saying. They're right.
They're not telling you what to do. They are telling you what people do.
All right. We are at the point, I think, where we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry. We have some people we cannot take. But on another day.
That's not nice to say about them. We can't take them. I'm sure they're very nice people.
I won't say what I'm thinking.
Good.
And it takes monumental self-control a lot of the time for me not to say what I'm thinking.
But I'd like to keep my job. You are a saint.
No. I just have a mortgage, and my wife reminds me I have to have employment. On another day, Dennis will come back.
Yes.
And we will talk again. In the meantime, look for his blog. What is that again?
The Web of Language.
Web of Language.
Just Google it, and it'll be there.
And he is also the author of some books. You might wander down to the library bookstore, look for some of his work as well. Thank you very much for being here. Dennis Barron, he's professor of English at the University of Illinois. We appreciate it.
Had a great time.
WILO programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe and Bevere Cafe 2 on the U of I campus. Bevere Cafe offers continental breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., lunches from 11:30 to 1 p.m. Tuesday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated and newly remodeled on the second floor of Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin in Urbana. That's it for us here on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. We hope you will. There's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about computers. Our guest this month, science and technology reporter for the News Gazette, Greg Klein. I'll welcome your telephone calls for Greg following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. Prices taking a tumble today in Chicago and in Kansas City. Kansas City is where we'll start. September wheat, 590.5, down 18.5. December, 607, down 20.25. In Chicago, September wheat, 603.5, down 17.25. December, 618.5, down 16.75. September corn, 334.75, down 20. December, 348.5, down 20. March, 361.75, down 20. December 08, 390.5, down 17.75. August soybeans, 871.75, down 50. September, 881.25, down 50. November, 898.75, down 50. November.